Hi, this is Katie Porter. How does the sound quality? Let me keep talking a little bit. I'm sorry I'm late. I received an interesting urgent message from the Capitol about my drapes in my office, which really didn't seem like an urgent matter to me.
From Politico, this is Women Rule, where we bring you real talk with women bosses. I'm Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent and co-author of the Politico Playbook.
I noticed on the campaign trail that the only people I ever heard say, running for Congress is the hardest thing I've ever done, were men.
That was Democratic Representative-elect Katie Porter. She's from a historically conservative district in Orange County, California. Women Rule is produced in partnership with our founding partners, Google and the Tory Burch Foundation. We also talked about what she hopes to accomplish once she's sworn into office.
I believe that we ought to reduce the influence of special interest money in Washington.
And what it's like to balance her new job with being a single parent to three young children.
You know, today I'm on this bicycle and I'm balancing the bike. My goal is just not to wipe out on the bicycle.
She'll be sworn in the House this week in the most diverse class Congress has ever seen. Representative-elect Porter, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Let's jump right in. So there's been so much attention paid to how the last year was the year of the woman, how many women won. I want to ask, though, how do you think you can take that momentum and carry it through once you're sworn into office?
For so many of us, our campaigns were about running as the people we are, running as moms, running as working parents, running as women who had overcome obstacles in our professions. And so I think we continue to bring kind of those selves to Congress. So I think what we are seeing is, and I feel this with myself, is that I'm not being asked to conform to some prior expectation of what a Congress member is, but I'm just getting to be me. And that person includes being a mom and being a woman and being a professional working parent and all of those identities.
Right. So it's not just like the woman with the pearls and the power suit anymore. We really saw a big shift, I feel like, in this election, more so than before, of kind of giving a little bit of kind of more of who people, women in particular, actually are, less of just kind of the box that everybody, you know, thinks that we should be to be able to be a member of Congress.
Yeah, women really, I think, opened up about who they were on the campaign trail in an unprecedented way. And I think we're going to see that transparency continue into Congress. So, for example, we've had people ask if they could follow my family around on swearing in day. And they know that that means that they'll be following around me and three kids. And they're interested in seeing how I juggle literally on that really important day professionally, but also a really important day for me personally, a day for my kids to get to. It's a family event for us as well. And so I think we've also seen just the incredible diversity of women. So we've had a diversity of men in Congress for quite some time. It could be more. But I think this is really a tremendous diversity of women. And that's really what's going to make a different feeling in the House office buildings going forward.
So you're still a few weeks away from being sworn into office, but give us a little bit of a sneak peek about what you've been dealing with in Washington so far, even, you know, back in California. I think, you know, there's everything from finding a chief of staff to what drapes are going to be in hanging in your office.
There's definitely a lot of logistics to be dealt with, and really making sure that I'm hiring a qualified, diverse staff, taking the time to respect the tremendous talent that wants to come and be part of our serving the people of the 45th District, both in Washington, D.C. and here locally. So it really has been everything from what color of paint do you want on your walls, all the way up to really important policy questions about things like, can we pay our interns given the House's policy that makes that very difficult to do? What kind of vacation? And we have to make our own employee handbook, for example. And so I'm bringing my experience as a working parent to how I think about putting together that employee handbook for my office. So it's really a range of everything. There's a lot of juggling, particularly as a mom. Holidays are a busy time. I've been at school performances at my kids' school 3 days already this week, and the week's not even over yet.
We'll talk about that. I'd be really interested in terms of, you know, you've talked a lot about being a mother, having three children that are young. How are you going to try to figure out that that balance? So many women that have been on this podcast that are members of Congress that have done it. I mean, that's kind of the hardest thing that they have found, particularly given the distance between D.C. and California.
Yeah, there's no doubt that being a parent, period, is one of the hardest things I've done. Whenever people said, I noticed on the campaign trail that the only people I ever heard say, running for Congress is the hardest thing I've ever done, were men. And I think for most women, they would never say that because they would say that being a mother or being a working mother is the hardest thing they've ever done. So I thought running for Congress paled in comparison to being a parent and being a mom, especially a single mom of three kids. So I have been interviewing childcare providers. I'm going to have a live-in provider so that I have someone there overnight when I have to be in Washington. And I've been really touched by the support that I've had here in the 45th District. Yesterday alone, when I was at my daughter's school for their World Fair open house thing, I probably had a half dozen parents who said, please put my cell phone number in your telephone. If you're stuck in Washington, if your daughter gets sick, if you need her to pick somebody up, please, you know, call me and I'll be there for you. And so that kind of community pitching in, it's what makes it possible for working parents, whether they're in Congress or not, to kind of do that juggle.
Let's shift gears a little bit on that. You don't have a stereotypical background for a political candidate who's running for office. Not only kind of you're a single mom, you're a professor, a consumer advocate. What sparked you to make that decision, given all the other things that you're juggling?
So for me, the decision kind of came in the political sense on election night, 2016. Watching, I was at my community center in my neighborhood. My kids and I had walked a block or two up the hill, and full of optimism, I had taken my daughter with me to vote that morning and explained that we were going to be voting for the first girl president. My daughter was five at the time. She was very excited. And we had gotten a full-size Hillary Clinton sheet cake. And as the evening went on, the women started to drink a lot of wine. a lot of the men went home to sleep it off. And the kids just ate that entire sheet cake unsupervised. But what was so interesting to me and what really caused me to begin to think about running was there was so much concern, uncertainty, and sadness around Trump's election. But none of my neighbors who are highly engaged, really talented people were commenting on the fact that our community had just elected Mimi Walters, my predecessor in the 45th District, and that her values for years really were identical to what we were hearing from Donald Trump on the campaign trail. And so there was this big gap between kind of people's focus and concern about the presidential election and Congress. On a more personal level, to be honest with you, it was really having seen Elizabeth Warren, my teacher, my mentor, and eventually my co-author and my collaborator, and it was seeing her transform herself from professor to one of the most incredibly talented and energetic leaders in Washington. And so having watched somebody do that, and having worked also with Senator Kamala Harris, and having seen how she was able to make a real difference in people's lives through her leadership, I think having those personal mentors for women is always particularly important, and I feel really fortunate to have had two of the most amazing women leaders in this country as kind of very, very early supporters and to have their advice as I made that decision to launch my campaign.
So were you asked? Did you stand up? How did you come to that decision?
No, I stood up. I wasn't asked by any kind of establishment or powers that be. Instead, it was someone close to me. I was talking about how I felt like there was all this lost opportunity that I had been excited about what I might be able to do professionally in terms of making contributions to policy under a Hillary Clinton presidency, that I would be able to testify before Congress, that I would be able to submit proposals and work with staffers and work with people in agencies to do consumer protection work to help give families a fair shot in our economy. And I remember saying, you know, all that is lost. It's just gone, and I have to wait 4 years. And this person said back to me, why would you ever wait for someone to give you the opportunity to make a difference? that doesn't make any sense to me. You can choose to make a difference. You could run for office. You don't have to wait around for Hillary Clinton or anybody else to make engagement and service possible. You can step up. And I remember talking with Elizabeth over breakfast around Thanksgiving, right after the Trump election, and telling her that I was thinking about running. And she heard me out and she said, "This is a good idea." And I remember she said two things very specifically. She said, "You will learn something every single day on the campaign trail. You'll learn something about an issue you didn't know about. You'll learn something about your community and what the challenges are that they're facing that you hadn't seen before. And you'll learn something about yourself and your own strengths and weaknesses. And so you'll always be learning. And I think that's why you'll love being a candidate." The other thing she said, and of course it was so true, was, "I will be with you every single step of the way." And she really was. She endorsed me on the day I launched my campaign. And on the day after the election, I called her to say, "Thank you so much for your help." She called me back and she said, "You know, Katie, this is heartbreaking. You worked so hard. You ran an amazing campaign. I'm so sorry you didn't win." And I said, "Wait a minute. I haven't lost yet." And she said, "Oh my gosh, really?" Because it was just, they were still counting votes in California. So she was so excited. And of course, a few days later, as they kept counting and kept counting tens of thousands of ballots that were mailed in or were dropped off at the polling place, we were able to pull ahead and I was able to celebrate with her.
So talk about that. I mean, you had that pretty strong stamp of approval there, but so many women in their careers, whether it's political or in the private sector, you know, question about taking that leap and having the confidence to move forward and to challenge themselves. So many oftentimes when you talk to people, the women, they say, "Well, you don't go for the job that's the long shot. You go for the job that you're already qualified for." What's your advice to them?
Go for the long shot. I mean, this is something I've seen and I think I reflected a lot on in counseling students over the years. I'll have students come into my office, and not always, but there is a gender difference. Men students will often come into my office and they'll tell me they want to work for this federal judge or they want to become a partner at this fancy law firm.
Right.
And I get a lot of female students who come in my office and they say, "You know, I kind of would like to do this, but I know it's not possible. So here are my six backup choices." And I often say to them, "Let's go back to what you really want to do and talk about what you have to do to set yourself up to be able to get that job." And so I see the same thing actually with work-family balance. I really never have male students come in and say, "You know, I've decided to pursue this particular area of law because I want to have children someday." But I get lots of women who come in and they've already kind of taken certain careers off the table within the legal field because they're concerned about work-family balance. And what I always tell them is, go day by day. You're going to figure out a path forward. You may come to a point in your career where you decide to make a change to better accommodate your family, but you have to kind of take that leap and have confidence in yourself. And I teach a class on transition to law practice at the law school. And one of the most helpful things for me was the realizing as I was teaching a class on work-family balance, that when we talk about that, we're not talking about balancing the kind of scales of justice. We're not talking about equilibrium balance. We're talking about balancing like when you ride a bike and your goal is just to keep the bike pedaling forward and not to wipe out. And so I think for me, having that image, you know, today I'm on this bicycle with it and I'm balancing the bike, and the bike requires me to go over hills and mountains and make pit stops for my family and make pit stops for my career. And my goal is just not to wipe out on the bicycle. And that's a different way to think about balance than kind of this perfect equilibrium where you're always, you're spending 4 hours on this and 2 hours on this, and you're always calm and the transitions are seamless. And that's not a realistic expectation for what work-family balance looks like for working women.
How did your kids, they're now 12, 10, and 7, react? Did they like get into the campaign or were they uninterested?
My kids were part of the entire campaign. And so it's a cycle. They definitely had moments that they were super excited about it. They had moments that they were like, Mom, why is this taking so long? And so the other day when I said, you know, guys, we have to start campaigning again for 2020, they said, what? I think maybe Mom just one term. They hadn't realized that it kind of starts back up immediately. But, you know, my son introduced me on election night. As I took the stage. And that was an incredibly special moment. And, you know, he said that I was his hero. And to hear that from your son, a 12-year-old boy nonetheless, was just an amazing moment for our family. My kids got to meet a lot of people. My campaign staff was wonderful about being accommodating of my kids. My one son was in the office yesterday shredding paper, and I said, how'd that go? And my staffer said, well, the shredder kind of overheated, but Paul had fun with the process. So I think that so many women think about campaigns as hardships that their children have to endure. And there's moments of that, but there were also a lot of moments of real joy for my children in this campaign and real moments of fun that we got to have together as a family that we wouldn't have had together if I hadn't been on the campaign trail.
We talked a little bit earlier in, on this podcast, we talked a lot about, you know, how women are treated differently on the campaign trail and in Washington, whether it's a focus on their appearance or their relationships. You ran into that a bit in your race with your own experience with domestic violence. You didn't really have a choice about whether to address it or not because people were talking about it. Someone on Twitter, I think, called you Katie, quote unquote, restraining order Porter. What was it like to have to share something so painful publicly?
I'm glad in retrospect that I talked about it. I think it was important part of my kind of processing what had happened. And kind of, I think one of the hardest things was realizing that I did feel ashamed as a victim. And I shouldn't. I didn't do anything wrong. And I got help from my family and kids. But realizing that I felt kind of really frightened about talking about this in the public, really concerned about how people would react. And kind of getting over that was really important because it's going to allow me to be a more effective advocate on these issues. And, you know, so many people, volunteers on our campaign, people in the community came up to me and shared their own stories of sexual assault or domestic violence. And it's altogether too common situations that people face. And so it wasn't my choice to do it, but I also think ultimately it was a positive thing. It was very hard on my kids. And so that was my number one concern, was feeling like that this would have an adverse effect on them. You know, I think, you know, people ask all kinds of interesting things. The single most common question I got on the campaign trail, it wasn't about my consumer protection work. It wasn't about healthcare. The number one question most frequently asked of me, and I always thought the phrasing was a little bit peculiar, was what will happen to your kids when you win? And I mean, what do you mean what's going to happen to them? They're not going to combust. They're not going to be for sale on eBay. I mean, what's going to happen to them is they're going to still be my kids. And we're probably going to celebrate. And we're probably going to go on with our lives. But it was sort of funny that, like, what would happen to them as if this was going to be something that was going to prevent me from still being a working mom like I have been my whole career.
Was it just the novelty, you think, in those, you know, that people hadn't seen a mom run for office, a working mom run for office, or what do you think was behind that?
So when I first would get that question, what will happen to your kids? And I mostly got it from women, by the way. At first, I felt kind of off put. I felt like, well, you're not asking this to male candidates,
right,
in my primary or in my area who have children who are even younger than mine. Why are you asking me? But what I came to realize over time was that a lot of the women who were asking me that question were genuinely wanting to know because they too are struggling balancing work, right, and family. And so it wasn't a question that was designed to discourage me, but it was more like, I know how hard it is for me as a working parent to juggle kids and work. I know the pressure that I feel as a mom, and the lack of of resources that there are sometimes for childcare and how difficult it can be. They really wanted to know, and they really wanted to get advice almost and to be part of the process. And so I think being a little bit more transparent with people about, yeah, it's going to be hard. I said to the parents yesterday, you know, I would love to have your phone number. I have people who can help me, but, you know, if my daughter gets sick and I'm in DC and I can't get a hold of someone, it would be great to have a backup person. And thank you for stepping up and being part of helping working moms succeed. And I'd love to do the same thing for you.
I want to ask, you know, when you think about the campaign and whether it was what was happening on Twitter or, you know, talk about your divorce as a disqualifying nature in your race, do you worry that, you know, people will look at this race and what happened and might get discouraged from running, or maybe it's a how to handle it, you know, kind of case study?
Yeah, no, I mean, I hope nobody is ever discouraged from running for office because of, you know, occurrences like a divorce or being a dealing with domestic violence or dealing with sexual assault. I do think it's important to respect people's personal privacy as much as we can in the political process. It is a big reason that women don't run, particularly because I think women think a little bit differently about the consequences for their children of having some of these things aired. And so I hope people don't feel that way. I really do think that ultimately it was good for me to grapple publicly with that issue and to kind of process it. And it was, I had to have some difficult conversations with my kids. But that's what parenting is about. It's about having some of those difficult conversations with your kids. And I remember my son saying to me, you know, this isn't anybody's business. This is our private business. And it doesn't affect your, it doesn't affect Congress, Mom. It isn't, you know, why are people asking about something that happened years ago that isn't going to affect whether you're a good Congress lady or not? And I said, I agree with you. I don't think it should be in the public eye, but this sometimes happens and we don't have anything to hide and we just have to address it and then go back to talking about the things that matter in terms of what I will be doing in terms of policy in D.C.
Well, let's shift to that. So you told my colleague, Rachel Bade, recently that Congress wasn't set up for members like you. What did you mean by that?
There's so many ways in which I meant that. But, you know, it's interesting. I'll give you an example is things like, you know, you win the election and you're supposed to be there like a week later. And in my case, I was supposed to be there the day that I won. So I pulled ahead on a Tuesday by a few hundred votes a week after election day. And I began to get tons of phone calls from my fellow colleagues saying, you need to get on a plane. You need to be in Washington. You need to come to new member orientation. You need to be part of the class picture. And, you know, it was like, you guys, like, I have to be home tonight to take care of my children. So I can't just get on a plane. And I was able to find someone who watched my kids and they had a great time while I was gone, I'm sure. But sort of the expectation that you can do these things. And I'll give you another example. I mean, the calendar for this year, I think Congressman Hoyer made a real effort to listen to freshmen and to think about predictability of the schedule. But, you know, we have this pattern in the House of having these votes at 6:30 at night. 6 p.m. is the start of the vote week. And that's not great for people with kids. So it would be much better if we just started in the morning. And that would allow people like me, particularly people with long travel distances, to take red eye flights and be able to be with our kids after school on that first day of voting. So I think some of these things are going to change. I think we're going to see women and men, working parents on both sides, begin to speak up. And one of the things I was really encouraged by when I was in D.C. for orientation was the number of men of young children, folks like Congressman Joe Kennedy and others who came up to me and said, you know, it's different for me. I'm a guy. I have a wife. But, you know, it's hard for me, too. And it must be much harder for you. And I really look forward to working with you on making Congress a more family-friendly place for the men and women who serve. And I think that is a wonderful development.
One of the big things that has kind of been the drama is the drama that's been ongoing for House Democrats has been Nancy Pelosi, her, you know, whether or not she was going to be able to get the votes for to become Speaker again. You've been a supporter. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, I said on the campaign trail that I would decide who I was going to vote for when I saw who the candidates were. And I think we have to be clear that the only Democratic candidate for Speaker is Nancy Pelosi, and she's a wonderfully qualified candidate. And so it wasn't hard to make the choice to support her. She's an amazingly accomplished woman. She's a fabulous leader. She's a woman of character, of moral conviction. She's an amazing mother and grandmother, and an inspiration to a lot of women like me. So for me, this was about supporting the most qualified person for the job, and that's clearly Nancy Pelosi. And I think when you approach it from that perspective, there's just no doubt that it's the right decision.
As you take the oath, you're thinking about what your, you know, objectives are, goals are. What do you think, what's the biggest priority for you in terms of the next year that you think is realistic, not just pushing kind of more of the Democratic ideals and some of these big picture policies, but things that you are really hopeful that can actually become law?
Yeah, I mean, I am hopeful that we're going to be able to get bipartisan consensus around campaign finance reform. I think that this is about our democracy in the little d democratic sense. And I think that that's really an important thing for the American public to see. If somebody isn't willing to stand up and say, I believe that our anti-corruption laws should be strengthened. I believe that we ought to reduce the influence of special interest money in Washington. I believe that every eligible American should be able to actually get out there and cast a ballot. Then I think that's something the American people need to see so they can take that into account as they go into the next cycle of elections here in 2020. And so I think that is something that I'm hopeful that we can see folks on both sides of the aisle come together to support.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Congresswoman-elect Porter. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Our show was produced by Jenny Ament. Our booker is Jessica Andrews. Dave Shaw is the executive producer of Politico Audio. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And please share our episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter and Instagram at @apalmerdc. You can also join the Women Rule community by texting WOMEN to 66866.